Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, understanding veterans in New York. A new report finds that today's veterans are more diverse, older, and more likely to face mental health challenges, including high rates of PTSD, depression, suicide risk, and alcohol misuse. We'll speak to the New York Health Foundation, who commissioned the report, about the challenges and opportunities for New York's newest veterans. And a world of culture in the Catskills this weekend. The Ardsley Dance Residency at Catskill Art Space is inviting the public to open rehearsals this weekend. We speak to the choreographer, Madison Hicks. Classical Kits here, speaking to Dan Garcia about his evening of Spanish and Latin American guitar at the Liberty Library. And Guinean balafonist Famaro Diabate's performance of traditional West African music. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Hurricane Milton is getting closer to Florida's Gulf Coast. It's got top sustained winds of 155 miles per hour. Heavy rain is already falling on much of the state. The hurricane will make landfall late tonight or early tomorrow morning. Officials have been pleading with Gulf Coast residents to seek shelter on higher, safer ground. The hurricane could shove seawater as much as 12 feet high ashore. Officials say that is not survivable. Many people evacuating from Florida have traveled north into Georgia. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Grant Blankenship has more.
Road-weary travelers stopped at an interstate rest area about 90 miles south of Atlanta. Many from the city of Tampa described a traffic-choked trip three times longer than normal, upwards of 15 hours to get there. Others described seeing car after car at the side of the road because drivers couldn't find gas. Giselle Martinez said the journey is no joke.
Like, it's really like you're leaving your life behind, so you don't know, like, what you're going to come back to or even if you're going to be able to come back.
Forecasters say there will not be another full day for Florida residents to evacuate before Milton begins lashing the Gulf Coast. For NPR News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon, Georgia.
An Afghan national has been arrested in Oklahoma on terrorism charges. The FBI says the suspect was plotting to carry out a deadly attack on Election Day in November in the name of ISIS. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
The defendant, identified as 27-year-old Nasser Ahmed Tawhedi, was arrested on Wednesday in Oklahoma. According to an FBI affidavit, Tawhedi entered the U.S. in 2021 on a special immigrant visa and is currently on parole status pending his immigration proceedings. The affidavit alleges that Tawhedi and a co-conspirator, his juvenile brother-in-law, were supporters of the Islamic State and plotted to conduct an attack on Election Day in the U.S. in the terrorist group's name. Tawhedi allegedly sold his family's possessions ahead of the planned attack. Then this week, he and his co-conspirator allegedly bought two AK-47 assault rifles and ammunition from a contact who turned out to be an FBI source, leading to the men's arrest. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks open mixed this morning after a big sell-off in China. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
Stocks in Shanghai tumbled more than 6.5% as the world's second largest economy falls short of government growth targets. Investors have been disappointed that government efforts to stimulate China's economy haven't gone further. The Associated Press reports tens of thousands of copies of a Bible being hawked by Donald Trump were printed in China. That's despite the former president's long-running criticism of China's trade practices. Talks between Boeing and its striking machinists have broken down, and the jetmaker has withdrawn its latest contract offer. Boeing says machinists did not seriously consider the proposal, which called for 30% pay raises over the next 4 years. The union had asked for 40% over 3 years. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. NPR has learned that President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are scheduled to speak today. This comes as Israel continues its attacks against Hamas militants in Gaza and widens its attacks in Lebanon against Hezbollah militants. Indian Americans are the second largest immigrant population in the U.S. As NPR's Sandhya Dirks reports, they could make a difference in this fall's election, especially in swing states like Georgia.
According to the Pew Research Center, around 68% of Indian Americans consider themselves at least Democratic-leaning. Now, Vice President Kamala Harris, whose mother was from India, is at the top of the ticket. Kannan Udayarajan is the Democratic County Chair for Forsyth County in Georgia. He says if Democrats can mobilize the South Asian vote, it could make a real difference in the election.
There is a palpable excitement. There are more people volunteering, more people signing up to do things.
He says the enthusiasm mirrors what's happening among Democrats in general. But some South Asian Americans tell NPR they can't support Harris because of ongoing U.S. financial and military support for Israel. Sandhya Dirks, NPR News.
Former President Donald Trump is expected to speak to supporters today in Scranton, Pennsylvania. That's the childhood hometown of President Biden. Later tonight, Trump is scheduled to hold a campaign rally in Reading, Pennsylvania. This year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry has been awarded to researchers David Baker, Demis Hassabis, and John Jumper. They've been cited for work with proteins. This could lead to new discoveries in medicine. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Over the past decade, there has been increased awareness that U.S. military veterans often grapple with significant mental and physical health issues related to their service. In response, many policies and programs have been put in place to support veterans and improve their access to needed services. But despite those efforts, rates for physical and mental health problems and concerns about the health and overall well-being of veterans remains high. The New York Health Foundation commissioned a new report that highlights those serious challenges facing recently discharged veterans in New York. The report, Understanding Veterans in New York, surveyed over 1,100 veterans discharged between 2018 and 2023, and the data sheds light on several pressing issues, including high rates of PTSD, depression, suicide risk, and alcohol misuse. Joining us now from the New York Health Foundation is Senior Program Officer Derek Coy with more on this report. Derek, thanks for being here this morning.
Tim, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
This report builds on a previous report you had. Can you explain a little bit about the report you do and some of the report you did and this report and some of the work that the New York Health Foundation does before we sort of dive into some of the key findings?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I think that's a great way to tee it up because originally what we had done is commissioned RAND back in 2010 to do a needs assessment of veterans throughout the state. And it really was a North Star for us to figure out what the needs are of veterans and speaking with them in particular, find out how best we can serve them. It really guided our work and was a tremendous resource for us to figure out how best to serve this specific population. But as you know, 2010 was quite a bit ago and there's been a lot that's changed within the military and veteran community, but also just nationwide, looking at the pandemic, the way that we fund certain programs. So we decided that it would probably be best to commission another study to pick up kind of where we left off and see what those changes are. And that's really what this study was looking to do.
So let's talk about some of those changes. This is, as you said, the first comprehensive look at New York veterans' health and social service needs since 14 years ago. What are you finding now in terms of, you know, key challenges that this population is facing?
You know, I would say, to be candid, one of the more frustrating things is that we're seeing a lot of the similar issues. I think there's been a lot that's been done. If we look at things just from VA, like the PACT Act in particular, which is the largest expansion of veteran benefits in recent history, it's great to see that there's been this huge investment federally, statewide, and certainly on county levels. But as the report shows, there's still quite a few veterans that have unmet health needs. And we're talking about mental health needs, physical health, and issues that I feel like, you know, no American should face, let alone folks that have served in the military, such as food insecurity, where about one in four veterans in New York are food insecure. And that's tragic, you know, just by itself. But when you couple that with the fact that veterans have a very high employment rate, that just reveals that veterans are out there working, contributing to their society, being active members of their community. And yet one in four still have issues knowing where their next meal is going to come from. So that's really heartbreaking to hear, but again, at least we know what these issues are so we can deploy some resources to make sure that these issues are addressed.
One of the things we mentioned in the introduction and one of the things I think that is probably somewhat widely known about the veterans is our mental health challenges. What are some of the mental health challenges that you discovered in this new report?
Yeah, well, I think one thing to point out, I think a lot of mental health issues such as PTSD and depression often get associated with military veterans, but it's something that happens to you know, pretty much any human, whether it's you're involved in a car accident or face trauma in some capacity. But what I think is important to point out here is that those issues occur, but what, you know, what's being done? Where can these veterans turn to? And one thing I would point to that I think is a bit of a bright spot is that it's no longer as stigmatized as it used to be. I think veterans like myself who've been in therapy for over 13 years, I'm a former Marine, and we can talk about these things. And I think it's great to see the veterans are saying, hey, you know what, I actually am having some issues. I'm having trouble sleeping, maybe experiencing some depression, you know, PTSD, et cetera. But the heartbreaking thing is that there are more veterans that are able to say, hey, you know what, I'm having some issues. But it's really difficult to not only find a provider, especially if we're looking at counties like Greene County, Sullivan County, et cetera, where it's really hard to find a mental health provider. And then on top of that, you know, try to find one that you really gel with, someone that kind of speaks your language, you can talk to a little bit about your military experience. So not only is it, you know, not great that veterans are having these issues, but it's really tough to know that they're, you know, kind of mustering up the courage and being brave and saying, hey, you know what, I actually would like some resources. And it's really hard to find. So that's really something that I think more folks need to understand, and hopefully something that we can continue working on together.
One of the things in the report that struck me is unmet mental health needs. As you mentioned, more folks are willing to come out and talk about it, but there's a statistic in here that many don't know where to find appropriate care. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that we're seeing nationwide. There's a shortage of providers. So it's really difficult to just find a provider in general. There have been some, again, I think some bright spots that have been the result of the COVID-19 pandemic, where we've seen an increased reliance on telehealth. So it's really great to see that, you know, you don't necessarily need to be in the office. Also helps destigmatize, so you don't have to worry about, like, you know, showing up to a clinic, et cetera, someone seeing you, which has been an issue historically in the military community. Again, I think if we're looking at specific regions, Catskills region in particular, telehealth is a great option, but sometimes there's a lot of places where veterans or members of the community just don't have access to reliable cell phone service or internet, which creates an extra barrier. And if we're looking at these rural communities, which, you know, oftentimes face higher suicide rates in particular than urban counties, that's an issue there that telehealth is not able to address on top of the shortage provider. So we're really seeing high need areas that just don't have access to the in-person providers. And even things like telehealth, unfortunately, aren't reaching all the veterans that are in need of their care.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Derek Coy. He is the New York Health Foundation Senior Program Officer, and we're talking about the New York Health Foundation's new report, Understanding Veterans in New York. It was commissioned by the New York Health Foundation and conducted by RAND, and offers a comprehensive assessment of the mental and physical health needs, access to care, and other factors like food security affecting recently discharged veterans in New York. It's the first comprehensive look at New York veterans' health and social service needs since 14 years ago. Derek, when we talk about unmet mental health needs as well, there is a certain part of the population that doubts the effectiveness of mental health services that this report uncovered. Tell us a little bit about that and why.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think this really does go back to a lot of stigma that's associated with mental health care. We've seen this in past generations. But I would, you know, point to the Vietnam veteran generation in particular, to the Vietnam veterans out there. Welcome home. We really wouldn't be where we're at today if it wasn't for you. And we've seen them advocate to say, hey, you know what, we've had some mental health struggles. And you've seen, you know, even PTSD being added to the DSM. In the early 80s, really because of Vietnam veterans. So there is still some stigma where folks feel like, hey, this might not be effective. But, you know, there's a ton of evidence out there. Again, anecdotally speaking, there's a lot of great word of mouth, you know, that they get spread through the veteran community, and something that I rely on heavily. So many folks that I've served with in the Marines and fellow vets in particular have utilized resources from talk therapy, group therapy. And I think if there are still some doubts, you know, we know what works. And one thing in particular is really great, especially in rural communities, is peer mentors. And you might have some doubts. And again, I think that's completely fair. And you might question the efficacy. But if you do, I think there's some really great mentors out there. You can look at the Joseph P. Dwyer peer-to-peer mentor program that's statewide, and reach out to folks, and you can see these groups and talk to other veterans. So you don't have to think this is some, you know, outside clinician or some larger federal entity coming in telling you to kind of open up and talk about what's going on. So there are those resources out there. Again, if there are vets that are struggling, that have some questions, lean on other vets. And I think we're seeing this being destigmatized again, starting by the bravery of the Vietnam generation of veterans. And I think it's really on us, myself, who served in Iraq, a post 9/11 veteran, to really build on what they've done and say, hey, you know what? It is okay to talk. And, you know, we do it in our barbershop. Sometimes we do it at a bar over drinks with friends. And we know it's helpful, but what really makes it, unique is when you talk to a clinician, someone who's trained to listen and has that competency to really give you the resources you need to continue serving. And again, I hope if it's something folks are contemplating that they could reach out and, give it a shot.
That peer-to-peer program you mentioned, or just talking to fellow vets, is that showing a preference for community care versus, you know, something like VA care?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really interesting question, because what we've seen and what the report shows that overwhelmingly the majority of veterans do prefer care in the community, not from VA or not from a military health base in particular. But what's interesting and kind of conversely is that trust in VA has increased dramatically over the last few years, and vets that do seek care at VA really do enjoy it. But when we're talking about access and unmet mental health needs, I think there's a lot of similarities between mental health needs and physical health needs. And what I mean by that is sometimes in some of these more rural counties, it's just hard to get around. You know, it's hard to go to a VA hospital when they're not as accessible. And oftentimes, if you're a veteran and you're already seeking care in your community, maybe that's where your family has care, you have good insurance, and you prefer to seek it there. It's really just a convenience thing. Do you like what you have? And I think what we're really seeing as there's increased trust in VA, but also an increased desire to use community care, it's really not a, black or white issue. A lot of veterans like myself will use VA care for certain, maybe military specific things, respiratory issues from burn pit exposure, Agent Orange, et cetera, where, you don't want to have to explain the specifics because this population of providers kind of gets what some of those more military specific issues are. But also you maybe just have a little bit of a cold, or you just want to get something checked out. You just want to go to the community provider. So I think a lot of veterans are realizing that it's great to have options. But again, in some of these rural communities, you can kind of only really take what you can get and see what's accessible and when you can get an appointment. So it's a challenge, but I think we're really realizing that whether VA, is accessible, that's important. But if they want to see care in the community, that should be on par. And community providers should be able to have this military and cultural competency to provide the best care possible, regardless of where a vet seeks care.
What are some of the opportunities or recommendations from this report that could improve services for veterans in New York?
Yeah, so one thing in particular, just to kind of reiterate, because I think it's worth bringing up again, is that if we know that veterans in particular are seeking care in the community, we've also known from a previous study that Rand did titled Ready or Not, which was looking at private providers' readiness to provide quality care to veterans. And it's really important to make sure that there's some cultural competency. Oftentimes, veterans will not self-identify. They might, think, oh, well, I served in the military, but I didn't deploy, or I deployed, but I didn't see combat, so I'm not a veteran. And they'll kind of, leave a lot of care options on the table. So I think one of the most important things that we could do is have community providers just screen for veteran status. Hey, did you ever serve in the military? And then on top of that, I think know what those resources are. Can you make a referral with the local VA community? There's great benefit advisors that can help veterans access care. And I think the other thing too is just realizing that, this report does a good job of showing, how things have changed in the last 14 years in the veteran community. And one is that women veterans are the fastest growing demographic in the veteran community. And again, I think if providers aren't, thinking that a woman might have served or certain people might have served, they might not be able to provide the best care possible. So a lot of cultural competency training, and I think just screening for veteran status so we understand where veterans are accessing care, where it's good. And then we could rely back on that kind of peer mentor community model where if a lot of vets are getting, great care at a provider, then hopefully that will increase access and, again, destigmatize and create more options for veterans so they have top quality care wherever they go.
I think it's important to note that many U.S. military members leave active service, return to civilian life without major problems. As a veteran yourself and someone who's doing this work, does this report encourage you?
Yeah, so that's a really great point. I appreciate you bringing that up because I think there is a lot of stigma associated with kind of the Rambo stories, if you will, where in media you see a lot of, kind of crazy vet narratives. And I think what this does point out is that the overwhelming majority of veterans do transition, relatively smoothly. Even if folks like myself with PTS and had quite a few mental health issues when I transitioned, we're still able to serve. We're still able to be active members in our community, hold down jobs, and contribute just like we did in the service. And I think what we're seeing here is not only that, most vets are in pretty good shape, but for the high risk folks, those are the ones that we really need to focus in on and not kind of associate some of these more serious issues with all veterans. And again, even with some of these not great numbers, I think the real important context is looking at how tough it's been, the last few years for just Americans in general, rural New Yorkers, et cetera. It's really hard out there to, find a good job. And again, food insecurity is not something that solely addresses, the veteran community. So on the whole, veterans, we're pretty resilient. We've been through a lot, especially these last 20 years or so. With the tempo of deployments and I think what's been asked of us. And we've shown up. And so I think it is important to know that, the overwhelming majority of us are continuing to be successful and contribute, but we can't, kind of look at the community as a monolith. And there are some, things that really need improvement. And I think this report does a good job of kind of showing both of those.
One of the other things you touched on briefly was about the growing diversity of the veteran population, that there are so many different folks who serve and that programs need to specifically address the unique challenges faced by these different communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think that's also something that we're seeing, kind of nationwide, statewide as well. If you look at, kind of these more rural communities or just something like Sullivan County, there's a pretty large growing Latino population. Again, as I mentioned, women are the fastest growing demographic in the veteran community. And I think if we're just kind of, looking at the veteran community as a monolith, we're doing a disservice to the very specific needs. And I think one good example would be looking at burn pit exposure and toxic exposure that, again, Vietnam veterans were champions of this with Agent Orange. And this new generation of veterans has really been able to build on the advocacy and awareness. But for instance, if you're a woman veteran, you might not necessarily think that it's time to have a mammogram. But if you tell your provider that you maybe were exposed to some toxic chemicals or you deployed, that might be life-saving. But again, if the providers aren't realizing that, of course women serve, they're the fastest growing demographic, and they kind of write that off, I think there's a lot of opportunities that get missed to make sure that a lot of these issues are addressed early on, which can literally be life-saving.
We've been speaking to Derek Coy. He is the Senior Program Manager for New York Health Foundation and their report, Understanding Veterans in New York. The report is the first comprehensive look at New York veterans' health and social service needs in about 14 years. It was commissioned by the New York Health Foundation, conducted by RAND, and offers that assessment that we've been talking about of the mental and physical health needs, access to care, and other factors affecting recently discharged veterans in New York. There's more information at nyhealthfoundation.org, and you can read that report there, too. Derek, thank you so much for joining us this morning and for shedding light on this.
Tim, it was truly my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the Ardsley Dance Company at the Catskill Art Space and open rehearsals for the public. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected this election season. October 26th is the last day to register to vote for the general election in New York State. Applications must be submitted in person, online, or by mail no later than October 26th. Election Day is November 5th. In-person early voting takes place in the 9 days prior to Election Day. And in New York, any registered voter may apply for a mail-in ballot. Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election season.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, matching strangers with different political beliefs to just have a conversation about their lives. Hi, I'm Judy Balaban, and I'm working on One Small Step at Radio Catskill. Help bring our community together, one conversation at a time. Go to WJFFradio.org and click on the One Small Step logo to join us.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Ardsley Dance Company is in residence at the Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor. They're inviting the public to open rehearsals this weekend. Contributor Isabel Braverman spoke to choreographer Madison Hicks.
Tell us about what you're going to be presenting.
Yes, of course. I will be there for a week in residence with my company called Moving Forward. And we are in a exciting period where we are really workshopping new excerpts of an evening length work that will be premiering next fall. So we have a few pieces already in the works. But what we're going to be creating during that week is completely brand new. And it's surrounded around the concept of age and memory, specifically pivotal moments of our childhood that we remember and how that lays, a through line for the rest of your life and how X connects to Z in the end. So it's all about, you know, the three dances I'm bringing kind of intertwining their memories and how they remember one another and then how they live in this current state of age. So we'll be workshopping it all week and then presenting it at the end of the week, potentially with a little bit more repertoire that we have in the company as well. I haven't been to the space before. I live in Manhattan, so I'm super excited to be there for the first time and be in the beautiful big studio space. We don't work with a proscenium stage. Like, most of my work is immersive and collaborative and set in a four-sided space. So I see us creating a work that kind of brings the artist into a very stepping into a world versus sitting in a chair and watching a performance from far away. So for the showing specifically, I plan to have the audience come in and walk freely around the whole space so that they can see the work from different angles and take away the boundary of what an audience and a performance really is, trying to kind of mold those two things and let people feel like they're entering our creative space.
It's really cool. And I love that the Catskill Art Space is doing this, because usually there you have paintings or sculptures are static, not moving. And this gives people a chance, like you said, to bring them into this world of dance.
Yeah, totally. A lot of my work is immersed in, visual art as well, and music, and bringing it all together. I have a dream of my own to one day have a performing arts gallery space in New York. So kind of what we're saying, what will live, in that space is I want people to come in just the same way they walk around in a museum. They walk around and see movement along with the still sculptures and figures. So it's really just trying to bring movement and dance into, broader communities and bridging the gap between, okay, we go and see a museum or we go and see a show. So trying to bridge those communities and that work.
What inspires you as a choreographer, and how do you go from being a dancer to being a choreographer? How do you wear those two hats?
Yeah, that's a great question. I like to say I've always been a choreographer. I think that embedded in you is at a young age, just like dance, just like singing, just like anything else. It is different than dance, though, in the sense that I'm a firm believer that you don't have to just dance your whole life and then transition into choreography once your body's given out. Mm-hmm. Some people, that path works for them, and I respect that. And also some people want to dance until their body does give out, and then, they get to put their passion into choreographing. I just knew at a young age I wanted the path of choreography over performing. So pretty early on, once I graduated with my BFA from Juilliard, I wanted to train more in choreography specifically. So I found a master's program with an MFA in choreography so I could focus on that just for a couple years, get some more education under my belt, And ever since then, I've been really predominantly focusing on producing my own work, creating my own work, creating spaces where collaborators can feel like they can contribute and, you know, let their imagination run free. So I kind of just took on the hat at a young age. I was like 10 years old and choreographing everything in my house. So yeah, it kind of became me.
Based in the city, have you ever been up here to this area before in the Catskills?
I haven't. It's my first time. I'm so excited. I hear it's so beautiful. One of my dancers participated in this residency 2 years ago with another choreographer. So she gets to go back, which she's so excited about. But she's been raving about how beautiful it is. And it's the perfect time of year that we're going. So yeah, I'm just excited to see the beautiful place and be a part of the arts community.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say you're coming at the perfect time.
Yes, I can't wait to see all the color.
Yeah. So going back to your piece, you know, that concept of memories and being a kid, can you give me an example or something of how you're going to portray that with the dancers?
The movement influences the age. I mean, the way that we reach and pick something off the shelf at 80 is going to feel different than the way we hop up there at 8 years old. Mm. So it really just, I create movement that can adapt to certain ages. And then we have a lot of play through improv and discussion and exploring as a team to find what visually best gives that certain age.
Mm. Wow, that's really interesting.
Thank you. It's really fun.
Yeah. What are you most excited for, looking forward to during the residency?
Nothing is better than being able to be like immersed in, you know, we get to stay together in the house and we get to like cook meals together and we get to like spend the night talking about rehearsal earlier that day. And it's so much more than just what we're going to do in the studio. I'm just excited about the whole week of like having the chance to really community build with my dancers. That's something that is really hard to do in the city when we're all working multiple jobs and going from thing to thing.
And audiences are invited to open rehearsals on Friday, October 11th from 11 a.m. Mm-hmm. to 5 p.m. And then the performance will take place on Saturday, October 12th at 4 p.m. And it will be followed by a talk back.
You know, I really hope everybody comes out so we can connect to the community even more. And like I said, they can really just step into the work and feel immersed in it and take it as a casual viewing and a sharing of work. So I'm excited to hopefully connect with a lot of the community there. And thank you for having me.
That was Madison Hicks from the Ardley Dance Residency at the Catskill Art Space, speaking to our own Isabel Braverman. More culture from around the world coming to our area this weekend. Next, we'll hear about Dan Garcia and his evening of Spanish and Latin American classical guitar music. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, it's Thanksgiving 1999, and a little Cuban boy is rescued from the sea.
We found a little boy floating about 3 miles off the coast of Fort Lauderdale.
That little boy was 5-year-old Elian Gonzalez.
We revisit the Elian Gonzalez story 25 years later. That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As part of National Hispanic Heritage Month, the Liberty Public Library is presenting an evening of live music with classical guitarist Dan Garcia. He's a native of Madrid, and he teaches music at Manhattan University. He's also the owner of the Beacon Guitar Studio. Our own classical kit spoke to Garcia about his authentic program of personal heritage with Spanish and South American compositions.
Liberty Public Library presents music from Spain and Latin America, an evening of live guitar music by Dan Garcia, on Tuesday, October 15th at 6:30. And joining me on the phone this morning is Dan Garcia. So good morning, Dan.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, could you tell me a little bit about your background and how you became interested in the guitar?
Sure. So I grew up in Madrid, Spain, and there were always guitars around the house, but we just kind of banged them around. We didn't pay a lot of attention to them, but my godfather, who was very close to me, was like an uncle. He played classical guitar, and he would come around the house and play. And, you know, one time, I think I was around 10 years old, I asked him to show me how to play a couple notes on the guitar, and he sat me down. He fixed my hand the right way, and I think I was just hooked right there and then. And he offered me free lessons as long as I practice. He's like, you can come every week, and I'll give you a lesson. And I did that for several years, since I was 10 till I was 13, and that was basically it. And then, you know, I haven't stopped playing since. That's how I got hooked to the guitar, basically.
That's great. And when did you come to America?
So I came here in, I have an American mother. So I used to come here in the summers a lot as a kid. But permanently, I moved here in 92. I came here, I went to college in Indiana, and then I got my master's in Cincinnati. And I finished in 98, moved to New York City. And yeah, I've been here since, early 90s.
Well, one thing I noticed reading your bio is that beyond all the classical repertoire you have, you play all sorts of genres of music. And I'm wondering if you branched out early, I mean, in your teenage years, or did you come to jazz and rock and other things much later?
Well, I mean, I took a break from classical when I was probably 13 as I entered high school, and I just wanted to, you know, rock out. So I got my first electric guitar. So I think I took like a 3 or 4 year break from actually studying classical guitar. And, you know, I just played rock through high school, and then I got serious again and went right back to it. Especially when I went to college, I was to study flamenco guitar in Spain. I was really interested in learning flamenco. And then, but I've always played rock, and when I was in college, both in Indiana and Cincinnati, I was always wanted to be learning jazz as well. So I played in the jazz band, I played in the combos, I took lessons from whoever could, you know, because I never wanted to be the classical guitarist that just played classical. I just, you know, I wanted that to be like the center of what I do, but I always wanted to know more about other styles of music. So I became very interested in jazz and world music, and like I said, flamenco, and so I play all those styles too. I have a Santana tribute band, which is super fun, and I get to play Carlos Santana. It's like amazing music, and I love doing that. And then I play a lot of projects with world music and all kinds of things throughout the city, and you know, with other people. So I guess with classical guitar, you get used to playing a lot of alone, you know, by yourself. And I always wanted to play more in ensembles and improvised music as well. So that's why I always had an interest in other kinds of music.
Well, I was speaking recently to an orchestral musician, and he was saying that there's certain pieces of music for him that are what he calls, give him what he calls goosebump moments. Like, they're pieces of music that he's heard, you know, throughout his life, maybe the way you heard Carlos Santana or something, that when you play it yourself, you kind of get this, a little bit of a thrill, because you're taking something that's been important to you, and now you're producing it. And do you have moments like that?
Yeah, I think all the time. And actually, I think that's what keeps you motivated, you know, to find those moments and to learn new music that maybe you've heard or maybe you haven't. And then that gives you those goosebumps that he was talking about, or see, you know, the orchestral player you mentioned, because that's, you know, that's really what makes us musicians. And you need to have that thrill, that motivation to always keep learning and keep practicing, because this is what we do. We just practice,
right?
And learn new music constantly, and that's what keeps us going. So yes, I would say all the time I feel that when I learn a new music, and and I decide to go for a piece of music, or I'm playing something that I've played for 30 years, you know, yeah, absolutely is my answer.
So you play all these diverse genres, but for the program you're going to be doing at the Liberty Library, will the focus be exclusively on classical guitar?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. For that, I'm just coming by myself, and I'm just going to play classical guitar repertoire from Spain and Latin America. That's like my classical guitar duty, you know, to just play repertoire and you know, bring it out to people. It's very it's been quite successful, I would say, to a lot of these library concerts. It's been very well attended, and people seem very interested in the repertoire and listening to classical guitar. A lot of people don't even know classical guitar exists, because, I mean, guitar is a very popular instrument in general, and rock, and everybody knows guitar, but I have people that come to these concerts and they're like, wow, I didn't even know this existed, this genre of guitar, and they've been listening to guitar all their lives. So,
right.
So for some, it's like a very new thing that they don't know existed, and it's older than any other kind of guitar you can think of, but, you know, it kind of goes underrated because the, you know, rock guitar and all kinds of other types of guitar have, you know, taken precedence, and classical guitar has been a little underrated. And it's still, you know, classical guitar is very underrated still in the classical guitar world, you know, because we're not part of an orchestra. None of the major composers ever wrote for guitar. So, you know, we don't have a Beethoven concerto written for guitar, or Mozart, you know, none of these big composers of the time wrote for guitar or paid any interest in guitar. So we suffer from that, you know. But, you know, we're there, and classical guitar is, I think, alive, and that's why I like to do these concerts, to bring more attention to it, you know.
Well, I heard Segovia live when I was a senior in high school, which kind of shows how old I am, but it was the first time that I'd heard classical guitar, and nothing like, you know, starting at the top there. And so it's always been of interest to me, but you're right, it's not something that you really have that much opportunity to hear live. I saw that you're going to be playing some things by, is it Tárrega? Is that the correct pronunciation?
Or? No, I don't think I'm going to play any Tárrega. I
mean, okay.
I'm playing Villalobos, I'm playing Ponce, I'm playing some Barrios and Albéniz, and I don't have any Tárrega in this program, but yeah, I talk about Segovia a lot because, you know, we owe him so much, and I know he died a while ago, but it's almost like the top of the pyramid of classical guitar has been chopped off, you know, and we really suffer from not having somebody like him around, because he was really the only person that could ever fill like Carnegie Hall and these huge concert halls, because that's how popular he was, and he really brought the guitar to those concert stages, and he elevated the status of the guitar, which was really his mission in life, you know, to really elevate the status of the guitar. And he did it very successfully, but, you know, we still have a long way to go. Still in the classical world, it's quite underrated, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, and going back to the concerts that I play, you know, that's the other side of the story. You know, like, I get a lot of people that have never heard classical guitar, but then I get people that are like, yes, I saw Segovia. I had this lady that I played this concert this last weekend, and this lady came up to me, and she told me she saw Segovia in the 50s in Carnegie Hall, and she was actually sitting up. Because, you know, he would fill Carnegie Hall so much, you know, he would pack it to the point where they would sell tickets on the stage, and there would be like, I don't know, 50, 60 people on stage around him sitting, you know, besides the packed hall. And she told me she was sitting on the stage with him, and she watched him play the whole concert from the stage. So I love to hear those stories, you know, about people that saw Segovia live. You know, I always ask what year that was and where, because I find it very interesting.
Well, you know, one of the nice things about the concerts in the library is that it does have that intimacy. You're not in Carnegie Hall, but you are essentially on the stage, because you're going to be close enough to really see so clearly. And I'm really looking forward to that. I also just want to mention that you also teach, and You teach at Manhattan College, which I understand now is Manhattan University, but you also teach, I believe, is it in Beacon?
Yes, so I have a studio in Beacon, New York, in the Hudson Valley, and I, you know, I run like a nice intimate studio with about, I have about 14, 15 students, you know, that come to the studio, and I teach classical guitar, and I also teach, yes, in Riverdale in the Bronx, and and Manhattan University. They just switched this year from Manhattan College to Manhattan University. But I teach here guitar and audio production, you know, all levels of guitar, from general guitar to classical, a little bit of jazz. And then I do the audio production class, yes.
And if people wanted to learn more about your concerts and your teaching, where would they go?
So my website is, you know, dangarciaguitar.com. All my concerts and projects are there. And then I have a separate website called The Beacon Guitar Studio. You can access that website through my other website too, but The Beacon Guitar Studio is a website dedicated to my teaching. You know, they can just visit thebeaconguitarstudio.com, and that would be the website to go to.
Great, thank you. And I hear you have your guitar right there. Could you just, you know, I have just a couple more minutes. Could you give us a little sample of something?
Sure. I don't know how well you can hear it.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how this comes out.
Okay, so I'll just play it for like a little minute. See, you tell me, okay?
Okay. Dan, that's great. I mean, obviously it's going to sound much better live at the Liberty Library than it does over a phone line, but that's just a taste of your wonderful technique and style, and I'm hoping that people will come out on Tuesday the 15th at 6:30 to the Liberty Public Library, and they can get more information at that at www.libertypubliclibrary.org. or by calling the library at 845-292-6070. So, Dan, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I'm looking forward to your concert.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for our own classical kit there, speaking to classical guitarist Dan Garcia. We'll take a break, and when we come back, more great culture in our area. Next, we'll hear from Famaro Diabate, recognized as one of West Africa's most talented and graceful balafonists. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl, and the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Radio Catskill's annual music sale is the Saturday after Thanksgiving, and we still need donations of high-quality vinyl, super clean discs, indecent jackets, collectible pop, rock, and jazz records, as well as genres that we don't often see at the sale, hip-hop, heavy metal, and experimental records. And what we need more than anything else is you, a collector who has cared for your records and would like to see them go to a good home. If you're a collector who needs to downsize, email feedback at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. This is a balafone solo by Famaro Diobate. Famaro Diobate recognizes one of West Africa's most talented balafonists. He's performing an evening of traditional West African music at the Outlier Inn on Friday. It's the inaugural concert for the Outlier Inn's new outdoor amphitheater in Woodridge, presented by the Hilltop Experience. And Famaro joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And we were listening to a little bit of your performance on the balafone. Can you explain to folks what the balafone is? It's a wooden xylophone.
Yeah, it's wood. It's come from we call this wood name Akari, or some ethnic group say Genu. But here, I don't know. I didn't see the wood, but it's similar to mahogany wood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's wood. Yeah,
and it's
wood. It's not metal.
It's crafted by hand in the Guinean countryside. You're from Guinea, and you have a long history. Your whole family is a prestigious family that plays this type of traditional music. Can you tell folks a little bit about your family history with this instrument?
Okay. First of all, thank you so much. I'm Famaro Diobate from Africa, West Africa, Guinea. Conakry, we have three Guinea in Africa, Guinea Equatorial, Guinea Bissau, Guinea Conakry. I am from there. So Guinea Conakry, I am Djali. Djali means like a living history book in Africa. So we are here for everything for people, like sadness, happiness, everything. So that's like a Mandé Society, give that opportunity to my family. We answer everything before from 1235,
mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of bunch of to say, but I'm come from that kind of family, living history book, Jali family, music, talking, poetry, everything.
And you live in New York City now and perform with a lot of other musicians. And at this performance on Friday at the Outlier Inn in Woodridge, you're playing with some other performers. Can you tell us who you'll be playing with?
Yes, I'm going to be playing with, my brothers. I have Mamfa Diobate from Mali, who can play Ngoni. It's a like a African banjo, because banjo come from Goni. It's like a six string, four string, whatever string you do. So we have a lot of people doing progressing about the instrument. So, and then we have a Baba Traoré, the one talking drums, the little drum talking. So from Mali, Baba Traoré too. And we have one great singer with us, Sayon Kamara from Guinea, big singer, and I, Famaro Diobate, with balafone.
You played at the Hilltop Experience in Cragsmore this summer. And you're coming back to the area. Folks enjoy your music, obviously. What does it mean to you to see folks dancing to your music and bringing this tradition to folks in the Catskills and beyond?
It's just normal for me. I'm happy, people, everything. We now it's try to change a little bit the thing, but, you know, the music, tradition music before a long time ago, you know, was so great, and people and what to, you know, come back to the tradition now. So I think I'm happy about it. I'm happy to be come back, you know, with these ability people right there, you know, to be come back, you know, play, give them again more group of, you know, like, you know, traditional music from Africa, Guinea. I'm happy about it.
Well, folks can experience it this Friday at the Outlier Inn in Woodridge, New York. There's more information at outlierinn.com. It's presented in cooperation with the Hilltop Experience. Famara Diabate, thank you so much for joining us. And we're gonna let folks hear a little bit more of your work as we head out here. And I hope you have a great concert this Friday.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Is Famara Diabate, world-renowned musician, at the Outlier Inn, Friday in Woodridge. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Before we go, a reminder that our election coverage continues. Tonight, you can listen to a special three-week event here every Wednesday at 8. We'll be bringing you a special from WNYC's Brian Lehrer and Marketplace's Kimberly Adams. It's a live call-in show, healthcare, housing, and the care economy, what the November election means for our money. Again, it's a live call-in show of the biggest pocketbook issues Americans face today, healthcare costs, housing, and the care economy. Listen tonight at 8. It's a national conversation, and you can join in as well. America, Are We Ready? 2024 with Brian Lehrer and Kimberly Adams, live tonight and every Wednesday in October as part of our continuing election coverage for you here on Radio Catskill. And be sure to tune in tomorrow night for the debate between Republican Mark Molinaro and Democratic challenger Josh Riley as they face off in a debate, the upstate debate for New York's 19th congressional district. That's coming to us live at 7 tomorrow night here on Radio Catskill, brought to us in partnership with a regional consortium of media in Albany, including WAMC and WNYT Channel 13. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This week, our live national election series, America, Are We Ready?, kicks off with a look at the presidential candidates' approaches to healthcare costs. I'm Brian Lehrer of WNYC. Join me and Marketplace's Kimberly Adams with our guest Julie Rovner of KFF Health News. We'll take your calls and talk about how the outcome of the presidential election, as well as congressional races, could affect healthcare costs. Join us for America, Are We Ready?
Tonight at 8 on Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election season.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Josh Gondelman was excited to find out that portions in American restaurants are finally getting smaller.
We won't even need the whole Cheesecake Factory. We'll have kind of a bespoke cheesecake workshop.
Exactly. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for artisanal, handcrafted jokes about this week's news. Plus singer-songwriter Kara Jackson on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Your You're listening to Radio Catskill Live, local music, local news, culture, and NPR. You can stream it live at wjffradio.org. Today's weather is cloudy, maybe some sun poking through, high 58, cloudy, breezy, low 40 tonight. Tomorrow, partly sunny, cooler, high of only 50. Tomorrow night's low 39. Friday, sunny, a little warmer, high near 60.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Made possible by listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org. Listen on air, live streaming at wjffradio.org, or ask your smart speaker to play Radio Catskill.